The difficulty sometimes is how we transform that intent, that dream of a better humanity into action. And sometimes in war is easier because it's easy to rescue somebody or to help somebody that is in need, to save the life of a little girl, of a child. While in peace, we have to really commit ourselves to do every day in the easy life that we have. We have to commit to put in action our intent to be more compassionate, more evolutionary in that sense, I think.
Hello world, it's me, Dennis, and we are in search of the new compassionate male. This is the podcast. I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay.
Hi, Dennis. Well, I tell you, we have Vince Didato from Sardinia with us today. And Vince, you know, we're in search of the new compassionate male. And right now we're kind of taking a macro view of things. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking to people all over the world. And I look at your background, and there's no way I can go through it all. It's tremendously exciting. But, you know, environment, social change, some military background. And the bottom line that I take from it is you're a compassionate man.
Well, I don't know if I am a compassionate man. I usually say that I'm learning to be. I'm learning to do that.
Because that's us.
Yeah.
That's who we thank you. Thank you, Vicente, because that's exactly where we are. We are in search of, rather than being at a goal of a steady state.
Yes. I always say that this life is an apprentice life. We are born to be apprentice, and I usually meet many, many teachers and masters around, but I am amazed because I don't think that such a thing can happen.
I love the idea of being an apprentice in our lives. You know, if this is my learning state rather than being a steady state. Could you talk more about how you about some of your process of getting there?
Yeah, I'm always been curious, of course, and I had the fortune to be in a family where everybody was curious, actually. Mm. So I grew up in that environment, in that broth of curiosity about life. You know, I remember my father and my mother the same, and I had the fortune to meet people that was curious the same, and my girlfriends, my fellow students and everybody that I met. And yes, of course, I met every kind of human as we all. So I evolved my conception that we are here to learn, and learning is different than studying. Yes, you are pointing out that it's not just studying at an intellectual level and intellectual state. It's learning. It's something more deep and metaphysical than and physical, of course, because we have to live this life. And learning is a constant activity, and I think is the main activity of the human beings. I studied design in my early stage of life, and I graduated in design first. And my myth was Richard Buckminster Fuller that was saying something like that. It was a wonderful human that was constantly searching and constantly trying to learn from life. And I unfortunately didn't meet him, but I would have liked that.
Mm-hmm. You met him through his experience and through his effect on so many people. But Mr. Fuller is such an icon.
Yes, yes. He is. I don't say it was. He was, but he is actually, because many many young people are still now, they are inspired by him. And he said 50 years ago things that today are very, very real, very, very present, I mm-hmm. can say.
Yeah.
And then I met many other teachers that, yes, they were defining themselves as learners. And I was saying that Mr. Fuller was saying the main activity, the main scope of the human beings is to be conscious in this universe. And so he was dreaming that we can develop this attitude of learning and being conscious in life constantly. And
boy, you know,
yes,
I want to go back when you know, the distinction between studying and learning. You know, it was years after school that I started to begin to understand that. I always attached a certain anxiety to studying. And when I could settle down and read deeply or look deeply at something, that's where the rich learning began. And my whole energy shifted and I was open. So it was easy to learn. Yeah. And it's, I appreciate that distinction.
Yes, I agree, and me too. I think that school should teach how to learn more than putting stuff into the mind of the young people. Because I think that life in ourselves has way more things to teach us than a school, an institution. Also, a school teaches how to learn books, and yes, books are fantastic. I have a big library behind me.
Yes, you do.
and I like to read books, and I like to write books and to translate them and everything that has to do with books. I think that outside my room here, straight outside me, my room, there is a farm, and there are animals, there are plants, there is the land, and there is people that has different lives. Maybe some of these people never read a book, and
yes,
they have a lot to teach me. And
yeah,
I think life is way bigger than the books. And I had a teacher, an African teacher, in my life that was used to say, universities pretend to put the universe in themselves, but that is impossible.
Mm.
The universe has the university in it. So it's something. Life is bigger than any book that we can write. And sometimes we pretend to put into the books all the knowledge that we have to learn.
Yes.
I don't think it's enough.
Vincent,
life.
Over the course of your study of the human being, of the evolution of the consciousness of the human being, where do you feel we are in 2020, coming up to 2021, are you hearing an appetite as you look around the world, as you talk with people, as you teach and learn around, are you seeing an appetite for the evolution of our consciousness, for you be able to put more, are you seeing some changes? You've been in Afghanistan, you've been in Iraq, you've seen conflict, you've seen opportunities. Can you give us some perspective? Are there some overall themes that you are seeing us evolve and challenges that we're having? See, we can only talk for what about 100 hours on that subject.
Yeah, right.
but could you help us from your perspective, please?
Well, it's a huge question. I usually don't like to give opinions. I think I have just an opinion on that. And,
yes,
and opinions are not supported by facts usually. So I will try to say something about that. I will try to at least express my feeling.
Yes, your intuition, your sense of what is going on, what is
Yeah. Yes, but please don't think that I pretend that is the answer. I mean, it's just
<possible. laughs> we're all searching.
Yes. For me, is more an hope. You said I've been in some conflicts in my life, in some wars, and I've seen the worst of the human beings also in that. And I don't think I've seen the worst, but a lot of bad things. And we can see bad things every day in our life, but we also see how people is searching. And believing is not thinking, is are two different things again, like learning and studying. I think that humanity grows in little increments, and everything contributes to this growth. Everything contributes to the evolution of humanity, even what we consider bad, or even what we consider destructive, is there because so we can learn. One person that I one of my teachers, actually, I could consider him my teacher, says that humans sometimes express the worst in peace more than in wars. In wars, really terrible things happen, but also you can feel the binding that is between humans, and we can find that in fellow soldiers, and in the compassion that we can find towards the people that we can meet in the war and right. suffer. But when we are in peace, sometimes we humans express the worst, and we have seen that in the last years, probably, especially in places like Europe and United States, where we have been in peace for so long. At the same time, if we reflect on that, there is a lot of people that is searching and that is wanting to do something with that, and want to do something with the challenges that we meet, and try to give some contribution to that evolution. And it's not only a matter of feelings. We have to transform the emotion in facts, in actions. And that is probably the difficult part. So yes, there is a lot of people that has that feeling. I strongly think that. The difficulty sometimes is how we transform that intent, that dream of a better humanity into action. And yes, I go back to the wartime. Sometimes in war is easier because it's easy to rescue somebody or to help somebody that is in need, to save the life of a girl, a little girl, of a child. While in peace, we have to really commit ourselves to do every day, also in the easy life that we have, we have to commit to be that, to put in action our intent to be more compassionate, more evolutionary in that sense.
You know, that's how true, wow. How powerful. Yeah, what comes to mind is you're talking about war and reaching out. It's more natural. And what we're learning is that compassion is innate, that it's that's part of our DNA, and science is proving that. And it needs to be nurtured. You know,
yes.
What came to mind to me was the Bible quote. You know, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friend. And
yes,
that's in essence what you're talking about.
Yeah, if I may share my military experience,
please do.
Because I come from also from a family that is a military for tradition, and in my family and myself, we are always been convinced that being a soldier, is a mission. It's a soldier is actually a person that put his or her now life on the line to protect the others, and that is the intent. My father, me, and my brother, we began our career, and we most of our career was in a certain kind of soldiers that were the mountain troops in Italy. That are quite famous. They are the Alpini, and they are famous because the spirit that animate this corps is mostly a spirit of service to help the others. In their history, is the first medal they have was for rescuing people in the mountains, not for a combat, and. Usually you meet these soldiers and they and maybe you have listened to their songs. They are always songs that speak about the normal life in the mountains, the mothers, the girlfriend, and the feelings that you have of the against the war, and not the macho attitude of some other we can see that in the movies, for example, not the macho attitude of the soldiers in the movie is more something that has to do with life and the fact that you put your life to defend the others. And I'm strongly convinced that the only good soldier is the soldier that has that inside, yes. not the soldier that feels strong because it can kill everybody.
No, we
the
have
soldier that is very conscious of that. Of my life is for the others. Mm. And yes, I have to use the force sometimes, but it's the very last resort. And that is my conviction. And it is my experience. And I join a part of the army in my missions in Afghanistan, in Iraq, that is the civil military cooperation. And we were in charge to support the population with some initiative projects and using something to help the others. And yes, of course, it's inside a complex mainframe that is the war, that is the intent of the nations to go in that place. I don't want to discuss that. My level was to take care of the projects that I was carrying on for the people. And I wanted to do that at my best because I had that in mind. The soldier is somebody that is a sort of monk, if you want. He puts his life for the other.
You know, that's so true. And that's so true. And that was the experience that I had in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And what that's translated more recently, and it echoes exactly what you're saying, is yes, we have the sword in one hand, and if need be, we use it. We hope we don't have to.
Yeah.
But to be a complete man, a complete person, yeah, the sword in one hand, but in the other is the hand of compassion.
Exactly. The flower.
That's it.
Yes.
One of the things that I'm trying to push here in the United States is that we have militarized our police.
Yes.
In the United States, we've militarized them. We've taken many of the excess military vehicles. We've given them to police, and so we now have that. But in the true sense, we had at one time a sense that a policeman was a peace officer.
Exactly.
And there's a difference just in naming that. If a person thinks of themselves as a police or they think of themselves as a peace officer, they are going to approach a situation differently depending upon where they're coming from. Does that resonate with you?
Yes, it resonates a lot. I recently read some articles regarding the militarization of the police in the United States, and I was shocked in the last months to see from my, if you want, technical point of view, how the police was interacting with the people, I was really shocked because I didn't expect that in the United States, I have to say. Then I searched and I studied how they were trained. And I really hope and I really that a complete reform will happen now regarding the police in the United States and as an example for the world, I mean, because we need that everywhere. But especially there, I saw how they felt that the people was the enemy. And if you militarize the police, obviously the people becomes the enemy. But that is completely wrong. That is a complete wrong way to do that. So, and I learned that the training recently in the last years has been focused on defending the officer from any threat that can come from the people. My grandfather was a carabinieri officer. So the military police in Italy, he during the Second World War, and he has been captured by the Nazis and he spent 2 years in a prisoner camps in Poland and a big adventure. And when he came back, he worked on the reform of the Carabinieri and the police in Italy after the fascism. Obviously, he was not a fascist. he was a democratic person. And the Carabinieri also are a good example of police at the service of the people. And they are teaching how to do that all over the world in missions. So I think, and sometimes they make mistakes. There has been recently a case a few years ago of a young boy that killed a carabinieri because he was too open to go to help and to interact with this guy, not taking enough precaution to defend himself. But I think that between the two extremes, to consider everybody an enemy and consider everybody a friend, there must be a way to be trained to listen, to evaluate the situation, to listen to people, and only in case of real threat to defend yourself. And it's very possible. Why we don't do that? It's and a big reform that can be a huge example for the other police corps all over the world. And
well,
that, yes, the United States can become this again.
I'm sorry. I've got to ask you, didn't you actually teach this, what civil military synergies?
Yes, I was a teacher at the Scuola Militare Alpina, the military school of mountain military school in Italy. For some years after my last missions. And I was teaching civil military synergies in order to teach to the officers that were going to be mentors and trainers for the Afghan army, how to exactly these kind of things, how to interact with the civilians, how to think in how to design the interaction of the army with the people, and that was exactly my matter, and I think it's so important. And I'm working on a treatise on Sun Tzu, and I'm pointed out this huge importance of not considering your opponent or your antagonist. In my treatise, I never use the word enemy. I always use the word antagonist. An antagonist is somebody that put a force against your force. So you apply a force against another force, and from that a resultant come out. It is physics. It's a result, a different result come out. But if you have an enemy, you try to destroy each other because think of that. You are the enemy of the enemy. So everybody try to destroy the other is sort of Clausewitzian madness into that. And while in Sun Tzu or in other vision of the conflict is totally different. we don't have to destroy anybody. We have just to understand that there is a force against another force, and the result must come out from that. And the result must be the synergy between these two forces. And this is the only way to have an evolution, not a destruction, because, well, you can win this time and be the strongest, but then one day somebody will destroy you.
When I was growing up, we would have the Western, there would be the fastest gun would be there, and there'd always be somebody that would come up there and say, "Okay, I want to try you to see if you're a faster gun than I am." They're always challenging. That was exactly that's exactly what you're talking about. There is never an out. There is never an out to that situation. There is never an evolution to the next.
Yeah. Yes, true. And I remember I was in Iraq and I was inside the battle at a certain point, and everybody was shooting everywhere in the night. And I was asking myself, why we are shooting each other? I know that this is not the thinking you must have inside the battle, of course. Now, I don't, please, young people, young soldiers, don't think that. Don't have that inside the battle. Think that before. But during that battle, I had this thinking, why we are shooting each other? I'm sure that if we meet somewhere along the road, we talk. Because the one thing that I was also teaching the other officer is human beings prefer to make business than to shoot each other. Every normal human being in history, in 2 millions of years, always has liked more making business and to talk instead of shooting it or eating it. If not, we wouldn't be here, of course. And so I think the fastest shooter is not a good attitude. This is something that doesn't work for a long time. Yes, as we say, there is always a faster shooter than you. One day.
And when you look at the children that you're interacting with and your teachers in the street, the people who are cleaning the streets, and are you seeing a light there? Because we are here. We're seeing little lights that are people that are wanting to do. Like, I'm trying to think of back in your grandfather's time, and being your grandfather's age that I am now, is that how hard it would have been for me to meet you, for Clay and I to meet you. But now, today, here you are in Italy, here you are in Sardinia, and we're getting a chance to have this wonderful conversation with you and to learn with you and to learn from you, where it would have been, where 20 years ago it would not have been possible.
Yes, I definitely think that the young generations are have more possibilities, actually, less possibilities in a certain way. Less material possibility, probably because of the climate change, because of the economy and everything. But we have more possibilities, and they will have more possibility to interact and to connect and to talk. And it's not just a matter of medium that they will use. It's also a matter of they can talk now. That is important. And our task is to let them understand that if they want to talk, they can talk, but they have something to say. They have to have something to say. That is very important. Not just small talk. It's important to express who they are and to share their dreams and to share their intent to do something. So, for example, I see young Africans making this very difficult journey from Africa to Europe, and they land here in Italy usually, or they land at the southern border of Europe. And of course, there is a lot of resistance, but I look at them and I say, wow, if I see young people, very young people, sometimes kids also with the mothers, and they have the courage to make this journey, and they have the strength to survive that journey, I want them with me. I want to know. I want to talk with them. I want to make projects with them, because they are the best people. They have the resilience. They have the intent. They have the courage, and probably they have great ideas also, because they have a dream. So why we Europeans, we don't understand that? we should embrace them and ask them what we can share together. I think it's very important. And so, yes, the young generation is really sparkling some here and there. And we have to put the wood to have a great fire. Yes.
I think they've got such a greater challenge than I know I had growing up. Like you said, the economy, just the environment, they've got to be more creative. And that's what I'm experiencing. I spoke with my niece some time ago, and she's in the human resources in a large corporation. And the way they're approaching it is so different than what we did. I thought we did a great job, but they actually embed the HR people in the operations. So they have an operational role and an HR role. That was just one of the things unique and different that they're bringing to the party these days.
Yes, I agree. I like what Clay said before about his niece. The fact that the HR is now embedded into the operation is a sign that the structure of the organization is getting more circular and instead of pyramidal.
Yes.
And I like that, because as a military, I tried to do that with my groups. Of course, the military is a very pyramidal structure, but it's not necessary, actually. I had a rank in the military, but when I was out in the operation, there was a sergeant with me that was responsible for things, and I was listening to him because he was the chief in that. He had to be. And I had to respect that. And of course, he was a human being, and we are friends now, and we call each other sometimes. We have been in fighting together, and we call each other sometimes. And he's a very good friend. I like his family, and we teach. But and please understand, for the American, that is easier because you don't have that feudalistic background that we European have. For example, the ranks in the military for a long time were a sign of nobility, and not a sign of a task that you have, but a sign of nobility. For me, a rank is just a sign of task. I have that responsibility. I have to perform that task. But if there is a sergeant with me, he has his responsibility, he has his task, but we are human beings. And of course, we share that thing together.
Boy, that
it's
is
not
so true.
I am above him.
Right. That is so true. That's and that's the essence of servant leadership.
Exactly. And, so we have a circular leadership.
I had the same when I was a fresh second lieutenant.
Yeah.
First thing I did is I grabbed the gunnery sergeant to the side. I said, "What can I do to help you be successful? I'm new here. You have all the experience. How can I clear the bullshit out from in front of you so that you can come in and do what you're trained to do?"
So, and you see how much more effective everything
is. Oh, yes.
Exactly. I love what you said, Vincent, about tell me who you are, not what you do.
Yes.
Tell me who you are, because if we get to that level, because we're doing this here in the United States. We're saying, okay, what is enough? What is enough? I live in a we have a 3-bedroom house here that we rent, but I mean kings didn't live as well as we live right now, and yet we have in the United States, we're trying to say, what is enough? You know, when would we know when we have enough to be able to then live the kind of life instead of constantly chasing a larger number?
Yes. Maybe we have to change the point of view. It's not a matter of enough. It's a matter of better and how. And it, for example, I gave up the car some years ago. I discovered that, well, I'm late. Bucky Fuller did that before, of course. but it's not necessary to own a car, for example. Why should I own a car? Why should I have, I don't know, 600 square foot house or 1,000 square foot house when a smaller one is enough, but I need more space outside and more trees and more water, clean water, and more people, new people to interact with, to understand more things. So I think that we are putting a lot of energy today in our society to preserve the status quo. But we are in a moment in which we have to reinvent, redesign our society. So we don't have to invent a new car to own, for example. I make this example, but please open that example to to the society.
Thank you.
We don't have to design a car to own. We have to design a car to share. And I was excited when I learned that the car will be self-driving at a certain point, because at that point, why we own a car? We can have vehicles that continuously move around, and I jump up and jump down when I need, and I put on stuff that I need to put on and carry the stuff in some place, and then I have my stuff in another place, and somebody get the cars after. So we in that way we have less parking lots and more green and many things. I'm making a very naive example, if you want, but that is another way to restructure and redesign our society, and houses will be different as a consequence of that.
Yes.
No garages, no spaces will be different, and the energy will be used in different ways, and our time will be different. And last month they invited me in Milan. It's 1 hour flight from here. I'm in an island in the Mediterranean, and they asked me to go to Milan to make a meeting, a 1 hour meeting, to prepare a training, online training, a school in Milan. So I told them, why we don't do that via Zoom? We use Zoom and we experiment. If we can make a meeting online, we can make a meeting, an online course, of course. And they agreed, and we discovered that I saved my money, I saved my time, and we saved a lot of emissions because I didn't take 2 flights to go there and 2 taxis and to go into the city. And of course, there is the virus, and it was unsafe to do that. So I think also the virus is a good opportunity, as every crisis is a wonderful opportunity to learn new ways. We are talking in this way. You don't have to come here to Sardinia, if not because you like to be here. That is another thing. But we can meet in this way, and we save air flights. We save many things. So fantastic. We are learning things that will stay after the virus. The way we work will change finally. We will interact and connect this way through continents, but also through different houses, and we'd be not necessary to spend hours commuting to work and using gas and time and resources and everything. So fantastic. We have to redesign our society.
And one of the things that I love the way that you're talking about it is that you're redesigning from the inside out. We first redesign our consciousness. And then, because if I can change everything outside, but I'm not willing to change, this is where we are in search of the new compassionate male. We are searching inside of ourselves first. We're saying, wait a minute, I'm going to have to change myself and be open. Like you were talking about being curious. Curiosity comes from the inside. It doesn't come from the outside. It comes from my willingness to learn and my willingness to listen. And then once we redesign that, now we can go out and make a better effect in the world. And we in my study of Sun Tzu, which is very, very light, only in the light, but Sun Tzu has a reputation as being war, all about war, without ever people thinking that there's something deeper. What got you interested in digging deeper into Sun Tzu and learning in this, that there's so much richer here than we might have known?
It's very interesting. The true title of the Sun Tzu treatise was not The Art of War. That was the translation that has been done the first time from French in French in the beginning of the at the end actually of the 18th century. The real name of the book of Sun Tzu is the title is Competitive Methods. If you translate from Chinese, it sounds competitive methodology.
Competitive methodologies.
This is a really important point to for us to be able to get into. Please continue.
Yes. So Sun Tzu is Taoist. Sun Tzu has been written, is older than that, of course, is a school, is way older than that, like Taoism. Taoism was older than that. But what happened in that time that all over the Asia and also Greece, if you think, there has been an urgence to write down the knowledge. And so Sun Tzu, both Sun Tzu and Lao Tzu has been written in that period. And it's a Taoist view of the conflict and start from the point that life expressed through conflicts, not wars, but conflicts. As I was saying before, you have a force and you have a counterforce, and that gives a result. So is deeper than that. It's not only a military treatise, is a life treatise about getting results from force and counterforce. So for that is so actual, it's so nowadays is so important to after 2,500 years from the first version. It's incredibly important because we have to understand. I usually say Clausewitz is dead. Hopefully is dead. Finally is dead. Because Clausewitz says that we have to destroy our enemy capabilities to win. And that is very primitive. It's absolutely primitive and unproductive, actually. But Sun Tzu was saying we have to preserve the antagonist resources as much as we can because we need them. And we need to build another choreography to use those together because we don't destroy our antagonists. We just position them in a situation in which is we have an advantage. And of course, an advantage for us can be a temporary disadvantage for our antagonist, but in the long term is a new choreography in which the advantages grows for everybody.
What a beautiful What a beautiful expression of that. You have a poetry in your English. The way of your thinking and the way that you bring it about is just extraordinary. And so thank you. I'm so moved by that. I love the choreography, bringing choreography into conflict to be able to, this is stunning. Is there anything that at the end of this particular segment of the show that you want to share with me that we haven't talked about?
We have talked about many things, and what is important for me is a question. I think that we always have to live with the questions. Actually, we cannot live as generation before was said, well, we have to have a conclusion. There is no conclusion. The conclusion, we are dead, and so, well, okay, that's done. But so, and still, also when we are dead, we have a question still there, and who we could have been. So I would like to express again a question that I had, that is, my big question is, how we can put in action all these talks and these ideas. This is very important. And I don't think that only one person or few persons can find that a way. Yes, we can find a way to do that. But it's very important that we connect together with more people to find many ways in many, many fields to do that. I know nothing of many things, so there is people that knows better things in economy or mathematics or how to make transportation work or how to to sail on the ocean. And I think that we have to ask ourselves how we leave the question open, how we can put in action our ideas. That is always every morning waking up with that, I think is a good way to live, I think, at least. Not easy, not comfortable maybe, but wonderful.
But wonderful. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Vicente, for this opportunity to be able to see you. I'm going to encourage everyone who is following our show to please stick around for the after show, and that we'll get a chance to continue. And I feel like I have met someone who I want to know better, who I want to learn from and with, in you, Vicente. And thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to spend this first part and to learn about you.
Thank you to you. And it's my same feeling. I'm honored and I'm really excited. I like this. Thanks a lot.
Our pleasure, and we will see you again. And please stick around for the after show on In Search of the New Compassionate Male.
It was a very good conversation for me, and I have to thank you. Yes, and you're doing a great project, and I like it.
The common thread is so much the same, expressed from different frames of reference. And at our heart, I believe all people are compassionate.
I think so. Yeah. Well, when you ask me, when you send me the email, I was just like that, you know. I said, well, what I know about compassion, I'm learning that. I'm not compassionate every time, and I just try, you know. It's I think it's necessary. At the same time, we are humans. We make mistakes. We get emotional sometimes, and we learn.
Yeah.
And so really, I hope that I had some, I gave my contribution in some somehow. That is in my experience, we very often lack of language when we want to express both mathematical and poetical concepts. We lack language in language. And mathematics and poetry are the two languages of this universe, actually, the only two languages of the universe. And when we try to translate that in words, it's very difficult. It's, sometimes we lack the words. And sometimes we use not the precise words. For that, I was speaking about the fact that courage is not the right word to express that, but and I struggle with finding some different word. Sometimes we find out, and so I think that mythology is a way to tell a story in order to go deeper in a concept that cannot be told in a different way.
Yes,
it would be too trivialized or too misunderstood in expressing it in other ways, I think.
I so agree with that. That story is what it's about. It was fascinating that you said that mathematics and poetry. And yeah. I suspect your definition of poetry is very broad.
It's the vibration of life, actually. The rhythm and the and the sound that life has and transposed transferred in languages, I think. So mathematics is that, is the expression of the vibration of the physics of life in expressing that way to communicate it. I think is that.
I love that. I really do. So much to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to have you back on the program.